This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In November 1985, playwright Tony Kushner experienced his first personal loss to AIDS. And that night he had a dream. The dream turned into a poem, and that turned into a two-part, seven-hour play, Angels in America. The production opened at a tiny San Francisco theater in 1991, and since then has taken the world by storm. It traces the politics, culture, and social turmoil of the 1980s through the stories of eight characters living in New York City at the peak of the AIDS epidemic. A new book of oral histories tracks the rise, evolution, and impact of that play. It includes hundreds of interviews with actors, directors, producers, crew, and Tony Kushner himself. Dan Coyce joins me now. He's co-author of the book, The World Only Spins Forward, The Ascent of Angels in America. He's also a writer and editor for Slate's Culture section. Dan, welcome to State of Things.
Thanks for having me.
Give us a recap. Remind us of what this play was. Certainly anybody who was around at the time heard of the play. It became a wildly successful play. But remind us of the plot.
The play follows eight characters, as you said, many of whom are gay men living in New York at the height of the AIDS crisis, many of whom are affected by AIDS in different ways. And it's arranged around several couples. One is a gay couple, one of whom is stricken with the disease, and his partner who abandons him in his time of need. One is a married couple, a married Mormon couple, one a Republican clerk for a local judge who is in the closet, and his depressed wife. And then there are surrounded by a constellation of other characters, including, most famously, Roy Cohn, the real-life McCarthy left right-hand man turned power broker in New York in the 1980s, who was himself a closeted gay man and who would eventually die of AIDS.
Tell us more about Tony Kushner himself, who he was and how he came to write this epic production.
Kushner grew up in Louisiana, but moved to New York to study theater. And he was a very politically invigorated playwright in the 1980s, a member of ACT UP and a participant in many protests in that era. And he also was, building a playwriting career at that time. And after some initial failures as a playwright, which is to say plays that were produced and loved by many but very, very poorly reviewed, he got a commission from a theater in San Francisco, the Eureka Theater, to write a play about the AIDS epidemic. Angels in America was originally envisioned as about an hour and a half long, a chamber play, possibly with songs, and four to five characters. And it, of course, expanded over the course of its writing and through its development into the kind of epic journey that it became, a generation-defining and era-defining piece of theater, one that for many people, for me, for example, feels like the defining work of drama of the 1980s and 1990s.
Defining and also crucial, as in a critical turning point in American theater, the idea of a seven-hour epic done in two parts in rep at that moment, which is not what was happening on Broadway, right? I mean, that's not the kind of thing that was selling seats on Broadway.
Well, at that point in 1993, when the play opened on Broadway, nothing was selling seats on Broadway.
Yeah.
The only thing that was big British musicals.
Yeah.
The idea of a straight play of any kind on Broadway, by which I mean a play that was not a musical, was not something that was happening on Broadway. Theaters were dark for years on end. No one wanted to put plays up. And so when Angels stormed onto the scene in the spring of 1993 as this, not only as a great work of art, but as a kind of hot ticket, the kind of play that gets, written up in Vanity Fair and has movie stars going to its premiere, it completely changed the economics of what people thought was possible on Broadway. And add to that the fact that it focused on these marginalized characters, characters who had not typically been the center of these kinds of plays. There had been plays before with gay characters at their center. There had been plays dealing with AIDS before. But Angels was bigger and made a much bigger argument than that. It made an argument that you can't understand American history, particularly the American history of the 80s, without focusing on gay lives and making them the center of that story.
Tell us more about your book, The World Only Spins Forward, and how it began. It begins as an essay, right? This is going to be a piece in Slate and then becomes a book. Tell us more.
Not unlike Angels in America. It started small and then got a little out of control. I'm an editor at Slate, and in 2016, I knew that the 25th anniversary of that first production in San Francisco was coming up. It's a play that I've long loved, a play that changed my life when I saw it, completely, you know, blew my mind and changed the way I thought about what art could do and what the role that politics could play in art. And I wanted to commemorate that in some way. I had this idea that the play was so epic, the origin story of the play probably was correspondingly epic as well, but I didn't really know the story. And in digging into it with my co-author, Isaac Butler, who's a theater director in New York City, it became evident immediately that, in fact, the story was epic, and that not only the story of the creation of the play, which we ended up telling in a Slate piece in the summer of 2016, but also the story of how the play then dispersed throughout the world and changed the lives of audiences who saw it across America and around the world and performers who were in it over that time. And so with the book, we're trying to tell a much greater swath of stories of the way that this play has changed just from being a hot ticket on Broadway in 1993 to being a work that has touched lives all over the world for the 25 years since then, in local productions and touring productions, through reading it, through seeing the HBO miniseries that won a gazillion Emmys in 2003.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what this play is and the centerpiece of it, these lives and the art itself that produced such an effect, Angels in America. What I'll do now, I think, is play a clip from a staged reading, and this is from some of the interviews in your book, some of the people you've talked to about the book and about both how it came about and its impact. Let's listen to this staged reading.
Birkenhead. In so many cities, we were surprised at the incredibly warm reaction we got, which says a lot about our own prejudices as sophisticated New York artists.
Swift. So many mothers would come to us backstage after the show and say, "My son is dying," or, "I just lost my son." We were still in the middle of the epidemic. We were in places where those losses hadn't been recognized. They needed to be hugged, and they needed to cry.
Goring, we had strangers come up to us on the street and do something better than compliment the piece. They'd tell us their stories. This person was living with AIDS. This person's heart had been broken. This person is a Mormon or Jewish or believes in angels. This person's a Democrat, a Republican, knew Roy Cohn, survived the Holocaust. They totally teach you. Audiences will teach you, especially if you hang out together for 8 hours.
I mean, we were like the gay Dallas Cowboys coming to town. I mean, we were walking through the country, sprinkling this magic dust that made it okay to celebrate your identity.
That's a clip from a staged reading of an excerpt from the new book, The World Only Spins Forward. It was performed for the Slate podcast, Live at Politics in Prose. And I'm here with Slate writer and editor and co-author of the new book about the oral histories that are about Angels in America. Dan Coyce is with me. He's going to be leading a similar staged reading at North Carolina State's Hunt Library in Raleigh next Tuesday, March 20th. Dan, that clip talks about how people around the country responded to the production. Tell us what happened in Charlotte, right here in Charlotte, North Carolina.
In Charlotte, North Carolina, in 1996, Charlotte Rep, a prominent regional theater, was one of the first theaters in the country outside of New York City to get the rights to stage Angels in America. You know, that it was fiercely contested between America's regional theaters to get the chance to put on this ambitious, epic-defining show, and Charlotte Rep got it. They were very proactive in their production. They knew they were in a town in which the gay themes of the play were not typically part of, you know, the mainstream art that people consumed. And so they very proactively reached out to community leaders, planned a bunch of talkbacks and sort of preemptive discussions of the themes of the play. And then they got bitten by that in the end, because a group called the Concerned Charlatteans, led by a reverend named Joe Chambers, wrote a letter to the city asking why they were supporting this pornographic material that was going to appear on stage, focusing specifically not just on the gay themes of the play, but on a brief scene of nudity that takes place in the play when Prior Walter, a character who has AIDS, is being checked out by his doctor. It turned into a firestorm in that city that made national news. There were articles in the New York Times and in Time and Newsweek about this conflagration in Charlotte as At one point, the city was ready to step in and shut down this show over these protests.
And interestingly enough, tried but was not able to shut it down. They tried both on decency and then, public exposure grounds, but in all cases failed to shut it down, right?
Right. Charlotte Rep very cleverly, took the offensive in this battle, went to court, got an injunction saying that the show could not be prior restrained, right? That prior restraint in this case was a violation of the First Amendment. You could not shut down something before it happened because of its anticipated content. And then, on opening night, they got the court to sign the order at 4:58 p.m. right before the court was going to close, and then fan process servers around the county to every government office they could think of that could potentially shut down the show, all the way down to the liquor board, and the show opened that night. And of course, as is often the case in protests against works of art, what they discovered on opening night was that the number of Charlotte citizens who actually came out to protest the play was very small. It was about a dozen. And the number of Charlotte citizens who came out in support of the play was over 100. And the community actually got behind the show. The show sold better than any show Charlotte Rep had ever done. It was widely viewed as an artistic and commercial triumph. And yet, within a few years, Charlotte Rep was no longer a producing organization because the courts shut them down, but because people got themselves elected onto city boards and defunded not just Charlotte Rep, but all city and county funded arts organizations in that area.
And that was due in large part to the pushback and the reaction to this particular play.
Yep.
So they sort of learned the lesson from that, but it was, wildly successful. There were 30 performances of this. Protesters showed up every night. Counter-protesters showed up. And it was the most successful up until that time, I think, or at least one of the most successful shows that they had ever done, right?
Yeah, and reportedly, sadly, I never saw it. I was a student at UNC at the time and did not have a car. So I did not get to Charlotte to see the show, much as I wanted to. But, everyone I knew who saw it told me it was an incredible, incredible show. Yet at the same time, it proved a kind of turning point in it is symbolic, I think, of a kind of turning point in the way that the culture wars played out in the 90s. Right. The attempt to just straight up censor art that many people who protested the NEA or other kinds of government funding of the arts would have preferred, is unconstitutional. It's very difficult to just censor art based on its content. And so the steps that happened in Charlotte have been mirrored around the country, including on the federal level, which is to say that instead of stopping individual pieces of art, you defund the organizations that make challenging art, and you make it so that it's a much more difficult financial environment for them to do what they do in. Around that same time, the NEA's theater department, for example, saw its funding cut by more than half. And only now, in 2018, have they begun to approach in real dollars, not inflation-adjusted dollars, the kinds of funding that they had to give to theaters around the country and to give to artists around the country that they had in the early 90s, the kind of funding, it's worth noting, that made the play Angels in America possible. Angels in America only happened because of a $50,000 NEA grant to Tony Kushner and the Eureka Theater to write a play dealing with gay themes in American life. Without that grant, we would not have that play.
Meanwhile, while there's an effort to cut public funding, it is a commercial success. HBO does an adaptation of Angels in America. It came out in 2003. Actually, I want to run a clip from that and then have you talk more about the HBO adaptation. Let's listen.
Big ideas are all you love. America is what Lewis loves.
So what? Maybe I do. You don't know what I love. You don't.
I hate America, Lewis. I hate this country. Nothing but a bunch of big ideas and stories and people dying and then people like you. The white cracker who wrote the national anthem knew what he was doing. He set the word free to a note so high nobody could reach it. That was deliberate. Nothing on earth sounds less like freedom to me.
That's a clip from the 2003 HBO adaptation of Tony Kushner's play Angels in America. I'm talking to the co-author of a book of oral histories about that play and its aftermath, The World Only Spins Forward, and Dan Coyce is with me now. Tell us about the HBO adaptation. Clearly, this is a commercial success, even if it creates this public firestorm.
Sure. I mean, the play did very well on Broadway and did really well in many productions around the country, including ones where it was protested, as in Charlotte and as in the national tour, which is the section of the book that we heard the clip from before. And people struggled. Various production companies and directors, including Robert Altman, struggled for about a decade to try and find a way to make it into a movie, not only because they loved the story, but because I think many people felt like it was time for a major Hollywood movie with movie stars to sort of address these themes and these issues. It was only in 2003, 10 years after the Broadway premiere, that someone finally managed to make it happen, and it was Mike Nichols at HBO in a production that was a fabulous success for the network, got huge ratings for them, and also won more Emmys than any made-for-TV movie or miniseries had ever won up till that time. And most importantly, I think, both for HBO and for the story that Angels in America tells, it had real movie stars in it. It had Meryl Streep. It had Al Pacino. It had Emma Thompson. It had these three headliners who were marquee names of the sort who, at that time in 2003, didn't do cable. Mm. And at that time in 2003, still very rarely would play roles in works like this, works that featured gay characters, that dealt with the realities of AIDS. And that, as we heard in that clip between Jeffrey Wright and Ben Schenkman, that is very critical of Reaganite politics of the 1980s and of the sort of dreams and ideals upon which America itself is based.
I'm talking with Dan Coys, the author of The World Only Spins Forward, today on The State of Things. I think that clip also illustrated the dynamics and the complexity of this play. It's a lot of personal relationships and interpersonal relationships and a lot of very big ideas, all sort of wrapped up in what is a wildly successful theatrical production.
Oh, yeah, and we haven't even gotten to the part about how the play goes to heaven. I mean, an actual angel comes through the ceiling and then, the main character goes to heaven and meets a bunch of other angels and gets a huge book with an aleph on the front of it in flames and has to give a prophecy to the world. Like, there's a lot going on in this play. And part of its appeal is its crazy, insane ambition. Part of what makes it fun to experience in a theater is to be sitting amongst these other people and watch for 7.5 hours these actors tackle this bananas vision of the world.
Why do you think it wasn't? You talked about it in the book, the Robert Altman attempt to, there's a screenplay, it's out there, but Altman was never able to turn it into a movie. Why not? Why do you think it could have been? I mean, obviously it's an HBO, it's successful on television, the small screen. Why not the big screen?
Well, the studio executives we talked to who are involved in its development in the 1990s at Fine Line made it pretty clear to us that there was no way they could imagine doing it in the theatrical climate of the 1990s that wouldn't have lost, scores of millions of dollars. It's the idea of making two movies with the kinds of stars you would need to put in it, with the kind of ambitious production requirements that a play like Angels that actually goes to heaven and would require a bunch of complicated special effects has, that the idea of getting American moviegoers to shell out their $10 to go see that in the kinds of numbers you'd need to make it a hit seemed inconceivable to everyone for one movie, much less two. And so it was only really through HBO and premium cable that the economics of a project like this could be made to work. HBO is willing to spend that kind of money because they are not judging the success of their shows necessarily on ratings, because they don't have to sell advertising against those shows. They judge the success or failure of those shows, especially in that era when HBO was working very hard in the era of The Sopranos to make itself known as a home for smart, intelligent, ambitious drama of all types. They judge their success on buzz. And Angels in America got a huge amount of buzz in addition to the large number of viewers it pulled in. It got written up everywhere, and as I noted, it won every Emmy you can possibly win.
Dan Coys, a writer and editor for Slate, co-author of the new book, The World Only Spins Forward, The Ascent of Angels in America. Dan, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Dan's going to lead a stage reading of the book at North Carolina State's Hunt Library, Tuesday, March 20th. We've got the details at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, a North Carolina poet with a new collection inspired by a close encounter with death. Stay tuned.